Welcome back to Remember What's Next, Season 2, with author, rabbi, Israeli tour guide, and historian Ken Spiro, and myself, JFI director and educator Ellie Bass. This is a show where we look to the past in order to understand the present and plan for a better future. And this season, we're touring Israel and learning about each place and its part in our history and our lives as a Jewish people today. Okay, let's do this.
Thank you so much, everyone, for joining us. Welcome back to Remember What's Next with Rabbi Ken Spiro. And we are going to talk today. I bugged Ken a little bit to speak about a question that came up in one of my classes around the idea of following the text. Like, what is the history of our texts? How did it move? What happened to those texts when we were kicked out of different countries? And how did we maintain the integrity of the narrative and the information that we have? And what got lost and what got saved? And so I would, you know, we're really curious to hear, how did our Tanakh travel around? And where do we start if we want to tell this story? So Ken, you're on mute if you want to just take yourself off.
I unmuted myself. My computer has a mind of its own. It mutes me. Maybe my mother controls it. I have no idea.
Amazing. Okay, we've got you. We can hear you.
Yeah, okay. So first of all, it's a very appropriate topic, Ellie, because we're actually, you know, we talk about the present and the past. We're in a very extended holiday cycle, because from Exodus narrative until Shavuos is actually one long extended holiday. 50 days between leaving of Egypt, where God puts us in to make us from a family to a nation, to take us out, not just to give us freedom, which is what Passover has often become in many people's minds, but it's freedom with a purpose. He brings us to Mount Sinai. So that's the completion of the process, which is the holiday of Shavuot. So we're right in the middle of that counting of the Omer, leading up to the receiving of the Torah at Mount Sinai. So it's actually a very appropriate time. We have to define some terms first. You know, we talk about the term Torah. It's a very, can be used to refer to the entire corpus of all Jewish knowledge. You know, even the books I write on history can be in some way, you know, they're Torah related. The most narrow definition of Torah is, you know, the five books of Moses. Then there's the 24 books of the Hebrew Bible. Then there's a little broader definition, the oral and written law, the Mishnah and the Talmud. And then there's all the later discussion and contemporary post-scheme, and then there's books of Jewish thought, so it's a really big term. But in its purest sense there, you know, to limit it down to the oral and written law, but more to the written law, we focus specifically on that because that is the word of God, so to speak. It has unique status insofar as to be included, anything included within what we call the 24 books of the Hebrew Bible has to meet two criteria, which are pretty straightforward. It has to be written by a prophet, number one. And that prophets are on many different levels. The greatest of all prophets is Moses, who was the dictator of the five books of Moses, which, as we know, are not the five books of Moses. They're really four books of God and one book of Moses, meaning Moses' prophecy has unique authority because he, as God himself says in the Bible, he's not like anyone else. He hears me speak directly to him. So it's sort of direct dictation, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers. The book of Deuteronomy is a different status. That's Moses' closing speech. Those are his words, meaning you don't usually hear the expression. The most oft-repeated expression in the Bible is Vaydaber Hashem el Moshe lemor. And God spoke to Moses saying, and then you're hearing what Moses is writing down. So he's basically the secretary. The book of Deuteronomy, which Moses is his closing speech before he dies. He's got everyone's attention because he's about to leave. We always listen to people before they're about to die. Last words are his words with God saying, okay, you could put my stamp of approval on, include it with the other four books that are my direct dictation. So that is the most central, like, corpus of what is Judaism, at least a good chunk of it. What people don't realize, of course, which is very important to mention, is that there's a whole oral tradition. It's important to also define what are the five books of Moses? What status do they hold? they're not the, we don't learn Jewish law from the five books of Moses. We never learn. I always jokingly say, you know, it says an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. Only some Baptist in Alabama thinks, you know, you poked out mine, I'm poking out yours. There's a whole discussion on the oral law, which defines how you compensate people for damages. So we don't learn Jewish law from that.
Meaning Torah is the principles, the values, the mission, the overview, the stories, right. and the context. But when it comes to actually extracting practice, we take those things and try to break it down so that we know what to do with it.
But it's more than that. It's actually, there's dictated simultaneously, and this is, it's worth going through the whole history of what was given when, and then going more into the actual transmission process. So it's not a book of Jewish law. It's not a book of Jewish culture. It has cultural laws, or all the mitzvot are mentioned there. Certain Torah portions. There are actually, I think, 17 Torah portions that have none of the commandments in them, and then there are Torah portions that are full of them. And there's certain ones, like, you know, Genesis only has one commandment: be fruitful and multiply. But it doesn't tell you what that means practically. So law is mentioned, but we don't learn how to apply the law from there. Mm. It's, you know, culture is definitely referenced in the stories, but it's not a book of Jewish culture. There's no like recipe for gefilte fish or cholent. It can't be a book of Jewish culture.
You'd think.
Matzah's there, but that's like the simplest recipe in the world. You don't need a whole book for that. And it's also not a book of Jewish history. There are historical events, historical people. There's, you know, all kinds of travel routes and currencies and culture mentioned, but these are side things. What the five books of Moses is about is hashkafa. It's our Jewish worldview. It's our basic operating system for how we process, how we're supposed to think as a Jew, just like your computer or your phone has a basic like operating system, and then you can add all kinds of downloads and go to the app store and put stuff in. But without the operating system, nothing else works. So it's hashkafa is the word. But it's also really important to understand, before we talk about the chain of transmission and how it got to us today, you know, what was given when. So when we leave Egypt, we go to Mount Sinai. At Mount Sinai, we know Moses goes up the mountain, and for just Sivan, the sixth of Sivan, he goes up and he just says hi to God. God says hi, and you go back down, and you're going to come up again, and you're going to tell the Jewish people to wait, and you're going to come back up again. And Moses spends 40 days on Mount Sinai. He goes down, he goes up, he comes down, he goes up again, and he spends 40 days doing what? What does he learn? I love asking people this. The oral law, the written law. He doesn't get the written law. He gets the oral law. And the simplest definition of the oral law, Allah, basically what Maimonides says, and he's always the purist. He keeps it very clean and short. And it's a great thing to memorize. I always tell my students when I'm teaching, you got to memorize definition of the oral law, is the 613 commandments and the principles of how to apply them. And they're simplest, most stripped down forms. That is what we get first before we get the five books of Moses. Because whereas the five books of Moses, hashkafa, we can't begin to live as Jews until we have that law. Hmm. So we get the 613 commandments and the principles of how to apply them. Now, without going through all the chronology, which gets very confusing, Moses comes down the mountain. He also gets the tablets, you know, God etched into them, the 10 of the 613, as to why those 10, too big a conversation, but there's many books written as to how they encapsulate all 613, or just really, you know, a greater, you know, explanation of the 10 basic principles that, mm-hmm. that contains all 613. He comes down the mountain on the 17th of Tammuz, which should have been the happiest day in Jewish history, because that would be the day that we finally get the Torah that we already, in theory, accepted. What happens on Shavuot, God says, it's like, you know, the guy says, I'm building a house on spec. You want it? You know, we say, we'll take it. We don't even see the blueprints. We'll take it. So we don't get the Torah on Shavuot. We accept it in theory. We only actually were supposed to receive it on the 17th of Sivan. Unfortunately, because of the golden calf story, and we thought Moses was dead, so then we have to go through a much more drawn-out process where he comes down, he smashes the tablets, smashes the idol, we spend 40 days doing tshuva, repentance, he has to go back up the mountain, he goes up the mountain probably three different times, according to it seems to be. But the third time he goes up again is on Rosh Chodesh Elul. So we've gone through, you know, Nisan, Iyar, Sivan, Tammuz, of, it's a big period of time. altogether, you're going through a huge chunk of, like, I think it's 170 days from the beginning to the end. On Rosh Chodesh, the beginning of the month of Elul, Moses goes up. The final time, spends another 40 days, because the Torah he learned the first 40 days, God hits the hard delete at the golden calf story. You know, if the Jewish people aren't on the level to receive the Torah, then our leadership is not going to be on the level.
Right.
So he has to go back up again on the first of the month of Elul. And he spends another 40 days relearning the oral law, the 613 commandments and the principles, how to apply them. And he comes down on the 10th of Tishrei. And we all know the 10th of Tishrei is Yom Kippur, the day we actually get the final version of, we get the oral law finally in our hands, is on Yom Kippur. And because he comes down with it, it's a sign that God's forgiven us. And there, the power of forgiveness and tshuva is all encapsulated in that period of time. So now we understand the first thing we get is the oral law, which will later be expanded and explained. The Mishnah of the Talmud, we'll get to that later. But going back to the original question of the five books, there's different opinions, of course, on precisely how it's transmitted. But given that many of the stories in the five books are only going to happen later, like the story of the spies, for instance, one of the biggest mistakes we ever make as a nation. If Moses knew about it in advance, we wouldn't have made the mistake. You know, where's the free will? So the basic understanding, if I can take the topic and simplify it, is during the 40 years from the time we leave Egypt to the time that Moses dies, that we wander in the desert, during that time, God will dictate to Moses anything that happened previously, like the creation narrative, the Noah story, Adam, you know, all of the Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob stuff. Once it's happened, God just dictated at his leisure, so to speak, to Moses as we're hanging out in the desert. Before Moses dies, he completes writing of the book and includes his final speech, which is the book of Devarim or Deuteronomy. The only discussion about is the last couple sentences in the book of Deuteronomy, where it says Moses died, was buried on Mount Nebo, and the people mourned for Moses. There was no prophet like Moses. There's two opinions. One is that Moses wrote that before it happened, which is a heavy thing. Can you imagine writing? And Ken Spiro died, you know, and here's where he's buried. Heavy stuff. He wrote it crying. The other opinion is that Joshua wrote the last couple. Joshua is the author, who's Moses' number one student and takes over leadership role after and writes the book of Joshua. Wrote those last few lines included in the book. So we understand that those first five books of the 24 books of the Hebrew Bible, four of them are dictated by God to Moses during the 40 years wandering in the desert. Moses includes his last speech. By the time Moses has died, he finishes not only one copy of the Torah, but Jewish tradition says that he wrote another 12 copies. So he wrote 13 copies, which is a pretty impressive feat given how many letters there are in the Torah, you know, over 308,405 letters, I believe.
So does that mean, say, like in practical on the ground terms, we're looking at this being written down like on a scroll, which I guess would be like an animal skin, written down, rolled up, and then carried with the Israelites wherever they are during that period of time? They would have had copies of this information. So when Joshua, say, crosses into the land, are they bringing those 12 scrolls with them? Is that how they're teaching, learning, et cetera?
Right. So first of all, it's 13 scrolls. One of the scrolls, Jewish tradition says, is kept inside the Holy of Holies. Where exactly it's kept is a debate. In the Ark, outside the Ark, we don't know. That's the original proof text. That's copy number one. And then copies are given that are identical. All the tribes have their own original copy of the text. By the way, interesting story. It says that before they cross the Jordan River, the water stops up and they write the Torah in 70 languages on stones and put it in the Jordan River, and they're here until today, the Torah says. They do the same thing on Har Eval and Har Bracha in Shechem. The same thing is repeated again. The entire Torah is written in all 70 languages on stones. Interesting thing.
Is that in Midrash? Is that where we find that?
It's explicitly stated. It's explicitly stated in the Torah and later in the book of Joshua and the stories of, yeah, we did it. It's a commandment to actually do it. So we finally have those first five books at Moses' death, and every tribe had a copy. Now, this is before the printing press, which only is around the last 500 years. which means that every Torah scroll copied since then is a copy, initially a copy of those copies, and then a copy of a copy of a copy. Now, if we put that on hold for a minute, we know that there are 24 books of the Hebrew Bible. Some were subdivided by later Christian publishers, like 1st and 2nd King, 1st and 2nd Samuel. The chapters, the verses are not Jewish. Those are added by Christian printers of our texts. But the word we use to describe the entire written law is Tanakh, which is really three parts. Ta is the Torah, those five books of Moses, which have a unique status because of all the prophets. His prophecy is the clearest and most direct. Again, every other book is written by a prophet, but some of them had visions. Some of them put their own words to what they saw, lower level of experience of God. Then you have the Na, which is the Nevi'im, the books of the prophets, which are eight books, including one book that has 12 minor prophets in it to make it more confusing. some big books like Isaiah, Jeremiah, those are these really big, Ezekiel, big books. But then there's a lot of like Habakkuk and Nahum and Ovadia that are all stuck into one book. It's called Trei Asar, but there's eight books. That's Joshua, Judges, Samuel, Kings. That's all the Jewish history and all those prophets that come later. And then there's 11 books of the Ch at the end is the Ketuvim, the writings. So it's the Torah, five books of Moses, eight books of the writings, eight books of the prophets, and 11 books, and 11 books of the writings, which contain things like the book of Esther and the book of Chronicles and the book of Proverbs and the book of Psalms and things like that. So those 24 books are considered canonized, meaning, and when was that done? There's a lot of other people who wrote stuff. The Talmud tells us, Ellie, that there was like a million prophets from the time of Moses to the destruction of the first temple. The stories in the Bible of, you know, people like groups of prophets, like you running around Jerusalem thousands of years ago, you'd see like 14 or 15 prophets hanging out at a cafe, drinking lattes and, you know, prophesizing about the Super Bowl or something.
If only.
A lot of them wrote stuff down. Yeah, exactly. That would be great. I always jokingly say if weathermen were prophets, they'd be working in the stock exchange. I know when to buy Bitcoin.
Correct.
the ultimate insider trading.
Amazing. So do we still have some of those texts today that didn't make it into the canon? Like, I know we have, say, the Maccabees, yes. We have Ben Sira. Right.
Yeah.
Are there others?
Those are not books written by prophets. Those are books written in the Second Temple period. They're called Apocrypha. They're often written in names of other people, like the book of Enoch. Enoch is a character who appears in the early book of Genesis. Some later Second Temple period author wrote this book and ascribes it to that ancient biblical character. These are not books of prophecy. They're Apocrypha and Pseudo-Apocrypha in this case. Because they are not written by prophets, they're works of literature, they're works of philosophy, they're works of psychology, they're works of Muslims. They have a purpose they're written for. Some of them are historical, like the books of the Maccabees. But A, because they're not written by prophets, B, because they're written after the Hebrew Bible was closed, and I'll explain what that means in a minute, we do not include them in our texts. The Catholic Bible, which includes the entire Hebrew Bible, also has several of these books in there, like the book of the Maccabees, because they wanted textual continuity between the end of our Bible and the beginning of their Bible. There's a big gap of many centuries between when the Hebrew Bible is closed and when the Christian Bible begins with Jesus's life.
So they take the apocryphal writings, include them as part of, say, the canon, so that there's historical continuity between the end of what they call the Old Testament and the beginning of what they call the New Testament.
So there's a lot of the Dead Sea Scrolls were, by the way, a very interesting part of that stuff also. There's a lot of stuff written or probably was written that we just don't know about. Probably most prophets prophesized and didn't write things down. The major use, most prophets' job before they were called Ro'eh, a seer, was not so much to be predicting or warning about the future and consequences based on the choices you make, but rather to be answering basic questions like you lost your contact lens in a football game. You could ask a prophet where to find it. As a matter of fact, when Saul becomes king of Israel, he's sent by his father, Kish, to find his lost donkeys, and he goes and asks Samuel. I always find it funny. I wouldn't bother the greatest prophet in Israel, the judge at the time, with such a trivial question, like asking the greatest rabbi, is my chicken kosher? I would say bigger questions for that. But he goes and asks, Saul goes and asks Samuel. By the way, Samuel, it's so great. Such a great story. One of the great things about being a prophet is you know the question is going to be asked before it's asked. So Saul approaches, he says, don't worry about the donkeys. They've already been found. And then he takes out his flask of anointing oil and he pours it on his head. And he goes, oh, by the way, you're king of Israel.
Talk about getting more than you asked for.
Yeah, getting a lot more than you asked for. Exactly. So, so the men of the great assembly, we have to go back in time. Let's go back. So these Torah scrolls are given to the tribes. And as successive generations living in the land of Israel, they want more copies of the Torah. They would go and copy the Torah from the scroll that came before, which came from the original scroll that Moses wrote. The further away you get, now, the more likely it is, since they're always written by hand, that errors could creep in, a scribal error. You could write a letter wrong. But if you had a question about it, now we Jews are obsessed with the accuracy of transmission. The general opinion today is that huge Torah scroll, but has one letter wrong, you cannot read the scroll. It's the word of God. You know, one letter off could change the meaning. But back then, when you had the original Torah scroll in your tribal inheritance area in the land of Israel in the first temple period, or during the book of Judges, or the first temple period, which is a very long period of time, you could take your scroll to your tribal headquarters or all the way back to Jerusalem to the temple and ask them, you know, can the high priest please go in and check, you know, the original scroll, or you could go back. And that way you would weed out any errors. Because occasionally, for sure, errors work their way in. Scribes are copying all these letters. They could read the word wrong. They could write one letter wrong. And the next scribe who copies from that scroll will include that error in his text. And maybe some additional errors that he makes.
Right.
You can do that. The problem is when the first temple is destroyed and the 10 tribes are sent into exile, and 130 years later, the southern kingdom of Judah is also, Jerusalem is destroyed. Those original Torah scrolls are destroyed. The Jews probably took some of these scrolls into captivity with them when they go with the lost tribes who disappeared altogether. But in Babylon, they had Torah scrolls with them for sure.
So that's what I was wondering, like, what do we still have any of that or text, any of those original scrolls? And if not, where did they go? If we don't, now what do we do?
So if you're always going back to the original scroll and checking them, then you're going to weed out. You're going to weed out the scrolls that have errors in. You go by what's called the eclectic process. You know, if you have an original scroll, which you know is accurate. Obviously, the scroll that Moses writes is the word of God is going to be 100% accurate because he's Moses. He's the closest thing to perfection, and God's dictating it to him. But once those scrolls are gone and missing in later periods of time, whereas one scribe would copy from another scribe and his errors would be transmitted to the next Torah scroll, you could always go and line up a whole bunch of scrolls and compare them letter by letter. The word for scribe is sophel, which comes from the word count. And the idea was that the scribes would literally count the number of letters to get to the 308,405 letters of the Torah scroll, making sure all matched. And if you came across, let's say, 100 scrolls, and let's say you had four that had a divergent version of a text or a word, you would always go according to the majority, because you would assume that all the scrolls go back to an original text, and one scribe got something wrong, and other scribes copied from him. And by that way, you would ensure that the errors would be weeded out. Now, just hit the pause button for a second, because during that period of Babylonian exile, which is around 70 years, we're in exile according to Jeremiah, there's an expanded Sanhedrin created, which is called the Men of the Great Assembly, the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah. It's 120 rabbis, as opposed to the usual 70, 71. Times of need, you need more rabbinic leadership, given that we lost the major features of Judaism, Jerusalem, temple service, etc. Those men of the Great Assembly did a number of things to keep the Jewish people together and keep Judaism functioning in diaspora, because Judaism was a religion that was meant to be practiced in the land of Israel, with a temple, with a king, with a high priest, with a temple service. They will institute any number of things, formalized prayer, for instance, regular reading of the Torah will be instituted at this time, things like that. They will also canonize the Torah, what is the Hebrew Bible. They will decide what to include. This is the traditional Jewish take. They will decide which books of the Bible we're going to include to make what we call the Tanakh of today, which means, practically speaking, Ellie, from 2,500 years ago, the Hebrew Bible is a closed book. What's in it, beginning with Genesis and ending with Chronicles, those are the holy texts of the Jewish people, again, meeting the criteria written by a prophet, big or small, and having a message that's relevant. And that is it for our written law, the Torah Shebal Peh.
And do we know exactly who those 120 rabbis were that made those decisions? Do we have a record of who they were?
Some of the names, not all of the names. As a matter of fact, if you want to get the short version of this, you look at the Ethics of the Fathers, Pirkei Avot, which is actually part of the Mishnah, which I'll get to. I got to explain what that is. We could have more than one class here because we've got the whole written law too. It's complicated. It's a lot of stuff to absorb. It's actually not so hard when you think about it. But it says in the Ethics of the Fathers, which is the wisdom of the rabbis of basically the Second Temple period, pretty much. It says, Moshe kibel Torah miSinai, Moses got the Torah from Sinai, and he gave it over to Joshua. This is the real process of what we call smicha. Not only do you physically put your hands on the head, but you transmitted all the Torah you knew, not the written Torah, that's you can read it, but the oral traditions that were passed down from Mount Sinai, which brings us to a great question. If it's oral law, then why is it written down today? We'll save that, different discussion. But you transmitted all your wisdom over. So it's Moses got the Torah from Mount Sinai. So what did he get? He got the oral law of Mount Sinai. He transmitted it to Joshua. Joshua gave it to the Skenim, the elders, which are the rabbis. The Skenim, they gave it to the men. And this is that whole period of time of they give it to the elders, to the prophets. The prophets gave it to the men of the great assembly. And the men of the great assembly are that expanded Sanhedrin. And then it starts going into what the men of the great assembly said. So you have the chain of transmission from Moses to Joshua to the Skenim, to the Nevi'im, to the prophets, to the men of the great assembly. And then the process gets a little more interesting after that. But you have a direct transmission of what is the oral law from generation to generation
right. Until
the time. And the men of the men of the great assembly have that other task of codifying what will be the final closed version of the written law. But the problem is that problem of scribal errors is going to continue. You know, a Torah scroll doesn't contain all 24 books of the Hebrew Bible. Those were traditionally written on other smaller scrolls, and they don't have the same authority. But where we want to focus on is those five books. How do we know what we have sitting today in our synagogues is the same Torah scroll going back then?
Especially and I think also, because in our class, one of the things that we're focusing on is Tanakh, like all of those, you know, Joshua, Judges, all of those things. So that would be the other piece that we want to know. Like, how did those pieces of the canon survive, and in what way have they either been changed, or how did they maintain their textual integrity? Because I can see what you're saying about the Torah being the primary. Like, this absolutely has to be exactly the same, because otherwise, what are we even saying? But how about these other things that are also prophecy, which I assume is also divine, but not necessarily the primary five?
Right. Exactly. Even if it's prophecy, doesn't mean it's predicting the future. It's just written by a prophet. It could be that the whole book of Kings and the whole book of Shoftim, of Judges, is not so much predictions and warnings and things like that, like Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel are doing, and Elijah and people like that. It's God telling the prophet how to record the stories to only include the information that we should be learning the lessons from, but it's not prophetic in that it's predicting the future. So one way of answering the question is, first of all, what are the oldest surviving texts we have? The oldest surviving texts we have are called the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Dead Sea Scrolls is a huge body of texts, most of which were found in a settlement area in the northwest corner of the Dead Sea that's called Qumran. Qumran was probably some sort of agricultural settlement. There's a lot of what ifs and maybes here. No one is sure exactly, but the general opinion is that probably one of many different offshoot splinter sects of mainstream Judaism were living in the late Second Temple period in this settlement area. That's a whole nother discussion of sectarianism in Judaism in the Second Temple period. You have breakaway groups, not extreme as you get today with Reform and Conservative, that have radically divergent ideas about the whole issue of authorship of the Torah and things like that. But groups that basically believe in keeping Sabbath, keeping kosher, believing in the divine authorship of the Torah, but more or less arguments over other issues and the authority of the rabbis and the corruption of the priesthood and things like that. But these groups, whether they wrote these scrolls in this place or merely moved them to this place, which is in the wilderness, And not all the Dead Sea Scrolls were found in Qumran. Anything found around the Dead Sea area is considered part, even the things that were found in Masada, the writings that are from a later period of time are considered also from there, part of the Dead Sea Scrolls. They contain basically two things. One is a lot of sectarian writings, meaning books that are not part of the Hebrew Bible, and also the rules of the community that existed, that their own special rules of purity and impurity and things like that, but also contain portions of pretty much every book of the Hebrew Bible. Unfortunately, not so much the five books of Moses, but we have the entire book of Isaiah, for instance, which is the biggest book of the Bible, 66 chapters. If you look in if you go to the Israel Museum, they have a copy of it on display wrapped around the central column of the shrine of the book in the Israel Museum. The original is not being displayed there, mm-hmm. but that's the entire book. So you can actually compare those books and the similarities. Not saying there's no differences, but the remarkably similar. Would that we had from 2,200 years ago, which is the oldest scrolls more or less from the Dead Sea, would that we had the entire Hebrew Bible intact. It would be the ultimate test, because that brings us to within 1,000 years of Mount Sinai and 2,000 years earlier. But we don't have that, unfortunately. But what basically happened from then on is that various, at different periods of time, there's one text I want to focus in on, especially in the medieval period, going between the 8th and the 10th centuries, they're called the Masoretes. The Masora is the tradition. These were people who were kind of obsessed with the accurate preservation of the written law. Some of these people could have been Karaites or were Karaites, because Karaism, which is an offshoot of mainstream Judaism, denied the oral law, and they were obsessed with the accuracy of, therefore, the written law. So they would really focus on it. The most important of these texts was called the Ben Asher text, and it was written by a guy by the name of Aaron ben Moshe ben Asher. And it was originally written in Tiberias in Israel about 1,000 years ago. And it's not written as a scroll. It's written as a book on parchment, handwritten. And it is basically the ultimate eclectic process of a guy who just went through all the different texts he could get a hold of, comparing every single book of the Bible and weeding out the discrepancies, always going to the principle we're going to follow the majority in each. If I have 100 books of Genesis that I can look at, I'm going to look at all of them. And if I see in 7 of them there's a different word written, I'm going to get rid of that one. And what I'm going to create as a Masorite is I'm going to create a master proof text which weeds out all of these differences.
And he did this for all the books of the canon?
Yes, the entire Hebrew Bible. It ended up, this book goes from Tiberias to Egypt. Maimonides talks about this as the ultimate accurate proof text. Maimonides in his Mishnah Torah goes through how you accurately write a Torah scroll. And that book we're pretty sure it went from Tiberias 1,000 years ago to Egypt and then to Iraq. And the Jewish community of Iraq had that book. Unfortunately, the best part of it was destroyed in a fire and an anti-Jewish riot around the time of the founding of the State of Israel.
Wow.
The rest of it is sitting in the Israel Museum today. But this is called the Ben Asher text, or as Maimonides calls it, the Keter Ramsava. The Keter Ramsava is considered the ultimate proof text going back 1,000 years ago, which contains the most accurate version.
What does Keter Ramsava mean? Keter's crown?
It's Keter Ramsava from Aram. From Aram is the area of Mesopotamia, and Keter is the crown.
Wow.
So this was considered the greatest, most accurate, because there's no question, to be honest, that errors have crept into Torah scrolls. But the question is, if the errors kept being multiplied and no one would correct them, then we'd have different Jewish communities with wildly divergent versions of the entire Hebrew Bible, but most importantly, the five books of Moses,
right,
which could actually lead to different understandings. Now, so that text, unfortunately, would that we had the five books of Moses from the Keter, it would probably destroy it, or who knows what happened to it, but that would have been amazing. Because this guy, what he did was, he basically put it all together 1,000 years ago, and we let all the errors back then. What's interesting is that there was a scholar who only died in 2007. His name was Mordechai Breuer. The Breuer family is the descendants of Shimshon Raphael Hirsch in Germany. And Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, one of the great, Enlightenment You know, rabbis of the period of the Enlightenment in the 19th century. So he has very interesting descendants. I know quite a few of them. They're very unique thinkers in the Jewish world. Breuer was born in Germany, I believe, but lived in, I think, Beit Vagan in Israel. He embarked on the greatest process of rechecking Torah scrolls ever done. This massive eclectic process, comparing as many scrolls as you can possibly find from divergent Jewish communities. One of the most interesting communities, Eli, is the Yemenites. Yemenite Jewish community was separated from the rest of the Jewish world for a very long time. They had all the aspects of mainstream Judaism, but they were just completely separated. And they claim their community goes back to possibly the destruction of the first temple.
Isn't that the same also with the Ethiopian community?
The Ethiopians are not originally of Jewish origin. This has been debated for a while. It's not because they're black. My Yemenite son-in-law is so dark. His nickname was Shoko, which is chocolate milk. So I have two kids married to Yemenites. So it's not a skin color. It's not a racial thing.
So, but the Yemeni Jews were separated.
By the way, even they're the one group of Jews who even genetically do not see, the Ethiopians do not have the Middle Eastern haplotype. They're probably their origins or some Jews went down there and a large number of them converted to Judaism. Their Torah scroll is written in Gez, which is not Hebrew. They don't have the oral traditions. There's a lot of things the Yemenite that Ethiopians don't have. They're kind of a separate group. But Yemenites as a community, which looks very different from, they look really dark. That's why I wanted my kids to marry them so they get some melanin back. You know, now I have my granddaughters. They're beautiful. They tan. They're like, great. I just burn, you know? So they have.
So in the Yemenite community, so in the Yemenite community, they basically have a text that say would be have been not altered or made mistakes in the same way because they were isolated from the broader community and didn't have access to this Ben Asher text.
Right. So they're completely separate from the Jewish world. Maimonides interacted with them, used to write to them because they were undergoing forced conversion. There's a very famous Igeret HaTeman. He was writing to them, trying to strengthen them in the spiritual pressure the Muslims in Yemen were putting on them. But no, the point is that their community was completely separate from the rest of the Jewish world for like thousands of years plus. Wow. And their Torah scrolls, which are copied only from their own original Torah scrolls that they brought with them. So when the Jewish people get back together and they bring all these scrolls back to Israel, the Yemenites bring their scrolls with them when they evacuated them, Operation, whatever, Magic Carpet, whatever they brought them on, whichever airlift they did with them, they bring their Torah scrolls with them and they are outside the fold. So when they compared this Yemenite scrolls, we're talking about, 304,805 letters, their scrolls, they found 9 letter differences between the Yemenite scrolls and the rest of the Jewish world that was doing their own little eclectic process. The Ashkenazi and Sephardi world get together. We start to get standardization of Torah scrolls and all the errors are weeded out. Once you have a printing press, by the way, you have written versions of the text, which no one argues over because there's never any errors in them.
Right.
Today, when people check scrolls, you can check it against the printed version in a book. Now computers do it, by the way. They can scan it. Mm. It's done very fast and extremely accurately.
But even like over a thousand years to only have 9 discrepancies in itself is like mind blowing.
And all of them, very important, all of them are called male v'chaser. Male v'chaser don't change the meaning of the word. It's like, it's just how you spell a word. It doesn't change. Like for instance, you Canadians, like you still use the British spelling, which is, I say, I always jokingly tell the Brits, they never got over the Norman conquest. They still spell like French people. Theater center is T-R-E versus T-E-R.
Right.
Doesn't change the meaning of the word, but English, American English evolved away from British English and spells it less, more phonetically correct as opposed to centre, but they still pronounced center by the Brits or the Canadians, thing like that. So all the male v'chaser, all the letter differences that we found, put the whole process together 3,300 years later after Mount Sinai, and especially Breuer's work, which is incredibly, he literally obsessed on this, comparing every Torah scroll, getting out. And they found basically that there are the few letter differences. There was, when the initial process came up with like 220 letters, differences in the scrolls, then the eclectic process weeded it down. I have a whole paper written on it. They got it down to literally less than 10. And all of them are yuds and vavs, meaning that's the only difference. you know, meaning none of them change the meaning of the word. By the way, there's several opinions in halakha, the Torah scroll, that have slightly divergent words where it's spelled slightly differently, but the meaning doesn't change, or kosher. We don't hold by that today. Today we go by even one letter difference, even if it doesn't change the meaning, the scroll is considered pasul. You cannot use it. You have to immediately stop using it. You put the cover on top. You tie it with the tie on the outside of the cover, and it has to be corrected or buried within like 6 months. So we're obsessed with doing this correctly. But now with the question, the real question is, Ellie, does that mean that the Torah we have today is the exact same Torah down to the last letter that Moses got from God at Mount Sinai? No, we can't say that. We cannot say that. But what we can say is that we have done the best job humanly possible in accurately preserving the text to be sure that overwhelmingly, and certainly whatever differences may have crept in, have no implications in terms of Jewish law, that we have a text in our hand that is remarkably accurate.
And are we as meticulous with the Nach and Ketuvim as we were with the five books? And were those preserved in the same way?
The good thing is that the rest of the Keter has all of that.
So the rest of that Ben Asher text that was put together has...
We have the rest of it. Wow, with all the notations, the scribal marks of how you write certain letters. There's also all kinds of traditions, how words are... Some words are written one way or pronounced the other, or you write letters big or small, or how you do this or that. All those... There's all kinds of scribal notation notes put in the side of the book that are really fascinating also. But yes, we have all of that. And by the way, if you want to know, Bar-Ilan University has put together a printed version called the Keter, which is based on the Keter Ramsava. And I'm sitting here looking at the books. It's the, hold one second. I know, run to get it. This one, here we go.
One thing I'm fascinated to one day see is whatever is in Rabbi Spiro's library. I'm so curious what's in there.
Most of my books are in storage. Koran. So this is Art Scroll. Now, Art Scroll has done a great service for humanity, but I have issues about the English translation of things and stuff. But the actual, this is just the Koran Sidur, but the publisher, Koran publisher, their Tanakh is based on the Keter. They have the most accurate version according to almost every opinion. The Koran Tanakh is the clearest, most accurate trend, and it's based on the best proof text that we have. So basically we can be pretty sure. We didn't even get to the oral law because it's too much to digest. We'll have to do a separate class on that, which we should do, by the way, before Shavuot.
Maybe we'll do another one. Yeah, let's do it.
That, because then we get the whole picture. But bottom line is to sum it all up. So everything that's, you know, we have the five books of Moses, which are four books of God, one book of Moses, his closing speech attached in there, written by, all done by Moses before he dies. Later books of the Bible that are written by different prophets, the men of the great assembly, weeded through all of them and decided to put it down to these entire 24 books, which are all written by a prophet, big or small, which have a message that's relevant to us. And throughout history, even though literally up until the last 500 years, we did not have a printing press. And even if we have printing presses today, you still cannot do a Torah scroll on a printing press.
That's actually like my last, one of the last questions I wanted to know was say, okay, when we talk, if our past episode, when we did the history of Ashkenazi Judaism and the history of Sephardic Judaism, where we're watching the population kicked out of the land, being spread out across the globe. So for instance, when those Israelites are leaving and moving up to the Rhine, moving up to Germany and becoming the Ashkenazi community, are they bringing with them the entirety of those 24 books? And how are they transporting them and how are they protected? That seems like a lot of text to protect when really you're running for your lives.
Yeah, they're definitely, again, we don't have the details of everything. We have the oldest surviving kosher Torah scrolls go back to the expulsion from Spain. There's one in the synagogue in the Yosef Karo synagogue in Sfat. There's one in the Avraham Avinu synagogue in Hebron. There's older scrolls that are no longer kosher because the ink, you know, is damaged, worn off. You can't use them anymore, but they're quite old. So we know for a fact that we have. It's a good question as to what is the oldest existing Torah scroll in the world today. It's a good question. I don't know. We have parts of scrolls of the Dead Sea Scrolls, but there's tens of thousands of fragments of scrolls. But yes, people were bringing them with them. in general, Ellie, books before printing presses, I have, this is not my library. My library is all in storage because I have literally thousands of books, power books and other books, boxes and boxes of them in storage now. But I have a far greater library than any medieval great rabbi who's 1,000 times greater than I have had, because books were all
the printing press.
Torah scrolls,
right?
Talmud, things like that. They were all written by hand. When Louis the Ninth burns cartloads of Talmud in Paris in the 13th century, St. Louis, you know, wonderful guy. That was a disaster. To own a printed version of any book was a luxury. I have my Opan teacher when I first came to Israel, Mr. Gabai, grew up in the Atlas Mountains in Morocco. He could read a Chumash, a Bible, upside down, sideways, backwards, because he said we used to sit in this little room, five or six of us surrounding the book, because we only had one copy. It wasn't handwritten, it was printed, but it was like rare. This is the 20th century, and he could read upside down, like perfectly. So people in general, text of any kind, be it the written law, be it the oral law, Talmud, Mishnah. And again, a lot of these books were written as not necessarily scrolls. Jews would schlep them with them, but they were extremely valuable. But the good news is why Mordechai Breuer could do this. When we finally get back to the land of Israel and everyone, all the different communities with the ingathering, the exiles are bringing to the four corners of the earth their scrolls and their books. Then finally, the first time in history after 2,000 years of exile, now a scholar sitting in Beit Vagan in Jerusalem could at least start with what is the most important, essential thing to start with, which is the five books of Moses,
right,
and literally go through scrolls that are from communities that took them literally thousands of years ago out of the land of Israel and never met up with this other community, and now we have them back. So what we know we have now is, to the best of our ability, a unified text that everyone agrees on. And all those differences that may have been accumulated by scribal errors and geographic distances have now been edited out. And we have in our hands today very accurate texts. And again, with technology and computers, now we can scan all these texts and make sure there's no errors in them anymore.
So the last thing I wanted to ask, and this question in itself might be a whole other class, but let's see. Maybe it's one of those things where it's a straight up answer. So one of the mysteries that I always thought was interesting is that the seemingly most important word of our text, which is the four-letter word that we have for God, we don't really know how to say that word anymore. And Jody, who's listening, also said, you know, if in that Yemenite text, the yuds and the vavs were mixed up and the four-letter word of God has those two letters in it, how could it be that if we're so meticulous about making sure we have this information, how could we have forgotten what could be really the most important word and we don't know how to say it? And is it possible that there was a change there?
Well, first of all, the letter differences, as far as I know, were not in the name of God. Yuds and Vavs mixed up were in different words, not in God's name. God's name has always been universally held as the Yud, Hey, Vav, Hey name. The problem is, how do we pronounce biblical Hebrew? That's right. A big debate. We don't know how. That name was only uttered you only heard it said out loud. That's why we don't use the J witnesses, because that's an anglicized version of the Hebrew name. And I've seen people using it, Christians who want to sound really biblical. They'll try and vocalize the word. They're almost certainly doing it wrong.
Right.
We don't know. And this is a really interesting discussion of, you know, what's the correct pronunciation of Hebrew is a very interesting discussion. You know, the Ashkenazi pronunciation, the Sephardi pronunciation. Yemenites have I spend a lot of time in Yemenite synagogues especially with my son-in-law when I go, and they have a J and they have a W. There seems to be a Th in biblical Hebrew, and probably the correct name to pronounce of King David's name is probably, from what I know, Dawith, which just means the Arabic of Daoud is closer because it's the W sound.
Interesting.
So the real issue is not so much how to pronounce God's name. That's a sub issue of how do you just pronounce these letters properly?
Got it.
You know, my son-in-law says Bere Pri HaJafen, and then they say Vaydaber Hashem El Moshe Lemor. You know, wow. And they have an ayin. Ashkenazim don't differentiate between an ayin and an aleph. We've lost the ability to vocalize. They have Sephardim seem to have the better vowels, whereas Ashkenazi may have the better consonants. We don't know. So we just don't know. That's one of the jobs when, you know, Mashiach comes and we reconstitute the Sanhedrin, Because all these differences that we have, which we almost glorify, I hate them. I hate all the things that set us apart. Mm. They're all negative byproducts of being separated from each other, Ashkenazic and Sephardic pronunciations and different customs and different modes of dress. And once we have...
Right, where we assert like the differences, yeah. Like everybody has the right way and you right, have right. the wrong way. And then it makes
the
us
beauty of having right. The beauty of having the Sanhedrin is once you have one legal body that whose jurisdiction covers the entire Jewish people, then we can finally decide like what nusach we're going to use, which version of the prayers. When the state of Israel was founded, it was the rabbinate of Israel decided to use nusach sfard, not Sephardi, but nusach sfard, which means that the official way we speak is the tough and not the suff kind of thing. And the vowelization goes according to that. And the official prayer book is based on Nusach Sfard, which is different from Sephardic, Middle Eastern Jewish communities, and different from Ashkenazi. But when the Sanhedrin's reestablished and you have the Messiah who would be the king and he reestablished the Sanhedrin, then the Sanhedrin can fix for us all the different customs and decide what all the Jewish people will keep. We'll all be keeping the same customs. No more like Sephardim eating rice on Pesach and not Ashkenazim doing it. I have my whole wish list that I'm going to give them.
Right.
The first thing is kidneys. Right. I want to get butter on my matzah. That's like
enough
that
with that already.
Enough. Make so much more pleasant if I can.
100%.
Peanut butter, jelly, and matzah sandwiches. It would be
unbelievable. Amazing. This was so fantastic. I think it was such a great overview to understand how we have the text that we have today, how we can understand it's been transmitted through the ages, and what exactly we're looking at when we open up a book of Torah or Tanakh. You know, what are these words that we're seeing, and how ancient do they go back? So thank you so much, Rabbi Spiro. We're going to end the podcast here and open it up for questions for people who are joining us. So I'm going to go ahead and turn off the recording.
Thanks for joining us on Remember What's Next. If you would like to get more resources and information about Rabbi Ken Spiro, please check out his website at www.kenspiro.com. If you have a question or an idea for a topic, please email us at rememberwhatsnext@gmail.com.